Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, March 8th, 2012, coming from you live from someplace on planet Earth. Now, I have a tremendous amount of material to cover tonight. First of all, I want to congratulate and salute all the women in the world because today is International Day of the Woman. I'm not sure if I have the exact how they say that, Women's Day or Woman's Day, but it's the international recognition of women. And where would any of us be without women? Well, thanks to all the women out there. And I should say, too, in the world that we are seeing today, women have to play a more decisive role. And I hope they do in the future. Not that men would not have to play a bigger role too, but we all have to play a bigger role. And some of the decisive events in history have been moved and shaken by women. And now we're in a time in history when some moving and shaking really has to take place in terms of politics, in terms of straightening out this world that we live in. So at any rate, I once said, and I'll say it again, that I believe that women should be the ones carrying arms in terms of home defense, because whereas a man will possibly hesitate, women would not, because they have to protect their houses and homes. And I should say, too, that in the world of today where bankers are robbing the public of their houses, of their livelihood, in the what we call the banker world, it's time to just start taking it back, and there's no easy way. Do you think these people are going to be nice and, oh, gee, we've taken your house. I think we'll just give it back and be, no. They're out to take everything you have and squash you down in the sand like a bug and then laugh at you. So understand who's doing this and what they are like. These are not swell people. They wear nice clothes. They wear suits. They're all buddies with people in the government. But their goal and their activities, if it's not a stated goal, is to rob you of everything you have ever worked for and your parents and their parents, and to rob your kids of anything that they would ever make in their lifetime. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a free-for-all, and I hope that women take an active role in taking this world back for the population. Okay. On to just a tremendous amount of activity this past week. The storms that rolled through the south last week. I'm sorry, I have not been able to update my web page. I put a posting on there that I had not found any natural causes of the storm activity, but that was done about a week ago. I've been somewhat out of the ability to get things posted. I'm back online now. But at any rate, the point is that, yes, we have had tremendous actual solar activity. Yesterday, we had an X5 flare, a mega flare, come out of the sun directed at Earth. It began hitting Earth today about midday, and it will continue. If you are in a clear area of the United States, which is most of the northeast of the United States, and most of the western United States from about the Mississippi River west, you should have extremely clear clouds, cloudless night tonight, so be sure to get outside and look for auroras. And I'm talking about deep south, too, in the United States, possibly farther south. And you may notice that they're a little bit more reddish color as the farther south that you get. As you get north farther, you will see more of the blues and the greens. Traditionally, that's the way it is anyway. So if you're not sleepy tonight, or if you can put on a jacket or a coat, go outside. And if you don't see them at first, the auroras come and go. It's kind of like a donut-shaped ring around the North Pole, with the North Pole in the center. and that donut expands and it brightens on one side and then the other side, and it kind of spins around as the magnetic field that's passing by kind of grabs the upper atmosphere and sends charged particles down into it. So at any rate, you won't see the aurora all night long. You might see it for 10 minutes or an hour, and then it goes away, and then it might come back in a few hours. So if you go out and don't see it, go out kind of every hour-ish to see if you can look up and see the northern lights. So it's going to be potentially a big night for northern lights. And remember that during the time of Moses, especially, and they were, of course, in Egypt, they talked about the auroras. It's very clear from the historical record and from other historical records that indigenous people saw the auroras very far south, as far south as the equator sometimes. So at any rate, the storm systems that roared through, went through the southeast United States, in fact, by the way, I was just about caught in one down in the southeast, but headed out east over the Atlantic before it hit, and it was a pretty rocky ride, let's put it that way. But I was not directly in that storm belt itself. I kind of missed it, but still felt the effects of it. That storm system is being duplicated tonight. Right now, there is a similar storm system stretching from Texas up to the northeast United States, and that is moving once again easterly, southeasterly through the United States. It's going to be a bad night for that whole part of the country, and this is absolutely a direct result of solar storm activity that's going on right now. The sun is coming up into its next solar cycle. This is normal. I mean, this kind of activity is normal. We haven't seen this for about 10, 11 years. This is the rise into this current solar cycle. So there's nothing unusual about what's going on in terms of the solar activity and its effect on Earth weather. I'm just going to go through my notes in order because there's this solar activity started around the 28th of February with a dozen big flares coming out of the sun, some of them Earth-directed. Yesterday, March 7th, we were hit, and then again today, we were hit with a blast of cosmic rays. And the way you see this, there are cameras that are watching the sun constantly. They're housed in the SOHO satellite that is about 1 million miles out in front of Earth, between Earth and the sun, constantly monitoring the sun. There are two cameras. There's a wide field and there's a narrow field camera. And what happens is when you see the CME and the blast come out of the sun, then about the same time you see that, you see white specks all over the camera. What those specks indicate are protons coming in at relativistic velocities, crashing into the sensors, the photographic sensors in the camera, the digital camera, and those streaks cause light in little streaks of light. And so what that tells us is that relativistic protons, these are traveling at the speed of light coming out of the sun, and I was the one that discovered these. I believe it was back about 1999. I was watching SOHO one day, and I saw these, and I immediately wrote an article and published it on the webpage. Weeks later, NASA was waking up to the, gee, what happened? And, of course, they followed my webpage then, as they do now. And eventually, the NASA scientists took credit for that discovery. I talk about that in the back. That's in the appendix of my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. There's a whole little write-up on that series of events. And with the magnetic disturbances, et cetera, that came with that solar flare in 1999. That's in the appendix, described in the appendix of my book, Atlantis to Tesla, and the Colburn Connection. So at any rate, right now the South is bracing for another set of storms. I found it interesting that one of the people I saw on the news, they said, we just got done rebuilding our house. We lived in a trailer house next to the house while we were rebuilding it. In the storm the other night, the original house was damaged 6 months ago. They had just moved into it, and the winds the other night blew the trailer house into the house and destroyed it again. I want to go on record as saying I don't see, as either from the results of the storm, damage on the ground. I don't see where these were tornadoes. I believe these were straight-line winds, probably up to 175 miles an hour, straight-line winds, which means that the jet stream, and we've seen this happen before, it happened in China. China had 300 mile per hour winds a couple years ago when the jet stream came down to Earth. Excuse me. I'm going to possibly lose my voice before the end of this show tonight. Okay, so at any rate, I think that the storms that we're seeing down there are straight-line winds. Of course, there are tornadoes mixed in, but also the video footage I saw, there really weren't tornadoes, and the descriptions given by the people, they said the clouds were low and rolling. Well, now this indicates that the jet stream, these are straight-line winds. And, of course, there are very few houses that are going to stand up to 175-mile-an-hour wind. But I believe that these are straight-line winds, and, of course, caused by the radical changing conditions in the solar wind. That's another thing that I discovered early on in my weather work, was that it wasn't necessarily the velocity of the solar wind or other conditions in the solar wind. It was the rapid change in those conditions that filtered down and had their effect on down in the troposphere where we have the weather systems. That's the zone around Earth in which weather occurs. It's called the troposphere in the weather meteorological terminology. But at any rate, I wanted to mention, too, that why February? It turns out that February is the most, the month most apt to have tornadoes. And that's something that most people don't realize. They think, oh, that's winter, it's calm, the tornadoes occur in summer. August is the other peak month for tornadoes, but February is absolutely the top month of the year. Why would that be? Is that just because it's spelled with an F in February? And does it begin? Is it because it's the second month of the year? What is exactly the question regarding February? Why it is the peak tornado month? Excuse me. I apologize for that. I'm just having trouble with my voice tonight. But the real reason, I believe, I looked into this and I said, okay, what's going on with February? What is it with February? Okay, well, let's count 6 months into the future. That would be August, or 6 months into the past. 6 months is about the pivotal point opposite in the solar system where Earth is. Now, I've already talked extensively in my books, etc., of the return current sheet that occurs around the month of August, and it's a wide, broad current sheet of protons and basically hydrogen, oxygen, other ions that come flowing back into the sun. The sun has an output of mainly protons, which are just the nucleus of hydrogen, and other ions that blow out in the solar wind away from the sun, causing the sun to be left with a net negative charge. This gives the overall capacitor that all of the planets and comets and moons and asteroids, all of them move through this, causing the electrical effects. That's I talk about that in my books. But this can't continue forever. In the electrical sense, you need a circuit. And so some of that flows back to the sun in a path. That path is where the Earth passes through in the month of August. And like any plasma current in outer space, it can be narrower, it can be wider at times, it can snake and whip around. And so you never quite know where that's going to be, but that gives us the peak aurora month, the peak hurricane month, and the peak tornado month in the month of August. But let's come around on the other side of the Earth, of the solar system, when Earth is on the opposite side of the sun. That occurs in the month of February. Okay, so late February, right where we are right now. So what could be on the other side of the sun? Well, if that current sheet corresponds with the positive influx of positive ions coming in from that side of the sun, then it would stand seem to stand to reason that on the other side of the sun, you are dealing with an electron beam, and that's also the exact same physical composition as a comet. Now, the sun is a comet in the greater galactic wind, so it would make sense that February is the time of year when the planet Earth passes through that zone, and it's a different type of zone. It's more concentrated, and so when we electrically connect with that zone, that's when basically these extreme storm systems can happen on Earth. Once they connect to Earth, once they connect down to the surface of the Earth and are attached to a storm down at the surface level of the Earth, then that's when these storm systems form. And of course, the jet stream is going to push that storm across the North American continent. It's going to push it in an easterly direction. There's a lot more details on that type of weather system. I explained that in my weather book. But at any rate, I wanted to give some kind of an explanation, and of course, standard science has no explanation, simply that the month of February, it's an observation that it is the month most prone to tornadic activity. And I should mention, too, that it's very, very rare, extremely rare, to have tornadoes, for example, in Russia or Europe. There was some tornado activity in London a couple years ago, which is extremely, extremely rare. So the North American continent, in the United States, the lower states of the United States, these are the only real tornado belts on planet Earth. There, you go to foreign countries, and they don't know about tornadoes. They've never heard of tornadoes. They don't exist in other places, so it's one of those strange phenomenons of the way the continents are arranged on planet Earth, the way the jet streams move around the Earth. And, of course, the other place you find tornadoes is on the leading edge of hurricanes. As the hurricanes come into Florida, for example, or the typhoons come into the Hawaiian Islands or the Pacific Islands or into northern Australia, or into Japan or China, the leading edge typically is beset with sometimes hundreds of tornadoes, and that's where a lot of the initial damage comes from hurricanes. Okay, so enough of that. I'll be talking about more of that in the future, but tonight, make sure you go out, if you can, and see the auroras. I'm sure they will be in most people's areas. And like I said, if you go out and you don't see any and you have a nice clear sky, look up. If you can see all the way to the horizon to the north, see, these are very high up in the atmosphere. And so you could be 100, 200, 300 miles away and still see them up in the atmosphere if you look north. If they're right over you, that means that the aurora extension has gone very far south. That donut that I was talking about, it's a donut-shaped ring of light that you can actually see from outer space that surrounds the North Pole. And usually that donut is pretty tight, close around to the Arctic Circle in that region. But when we have severe storms, solar storms like we're having today and tonight, that region moves farther south. As I said, sometimes historically being seen as far south as Egypt or in tropical areas. I just wanted to make a comment, and this comes from, I did many, many shows on Comet Lovejoy, and I wanted to, those videos are still available on the internet. There's many copies of them around, and what I wanted you to notice, if you go and see one of these, just look for the video of Comet Lovejoy. Watch as the comet comes into the sun. And okay, now it's pulling the tail in, and this is my theoretical explanation for a comet, that the tail is being pulled into the comet nucleus by strong electrical forces, and these electrical forces are generated by an electric field on the comet nucleus, and that's part of the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. But what's important to see in the video is the tail is being pulled into the comet. Especially you see this as the comet gets closer to the sun, the action picks up, the motion picks up, and moves much faster. You can see the tail being pulled into the comet nucleus. Now when the comet nucleus gets closer to the sun, the tail is stretched out behind it, and all of a sudden the tail releases as the comet gets down right close to the sun. The comet tail releases. You still see that comet tail moving in towards the nucleus area. And then it very slowly starts to drift away in the solar wind. The point is you can see that tail still moving in towards the nucleus, following that nucleus in, and that is proof positive, 100%, 180% proof positive that the comet tail is following the nucleus. You sure didn't hear any of the NASA scientists talking about that. They gave themselves 600 years to figure out what's going on, and I guess if I were them, I'd probably give myself a couple thousand at the rate they're going. But the tail definitively following the comet nucleus in towards the sun, and then when it comes around the other side and forms the tail again, very clear that that tail material is building and coming into the comet nucleus, and certainly in all stretches of the imagination, a little 600-foot dirty snowball that they're talking about in standard science going through the atmosphere of the sun and coming out the other side and being visible to the naked eye on the other side of the sun beyond your wildest dreams of absurdity and ridiculous science. I just wanted to make a point here, and this came out today when I'll be talking about sunspots here, the main science topic. I'll be talking about the characteristics of sunspots. But here's a good attribute of sunspots, kind of a well-known fact in sunspots. Some of the sunspots can be seen by equipment at Earth. I'll be talking about sunspots. I have to preface this with a caution. Never, 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 ever look at the sun with your eyes or through any optical equipment. There are filters that are made for, they're made out of aluminum foil or other opaque materials. Another way of viewing the sun is take a piece of paper or a piece of dark paper. Put a pinhole in it and then hold it above the ground or the sidewalk, and the image of the sun will be cast on the sidewalk, and you should be able to see sunspots on that image. But for you to see images like that in that kind of resolution, those sunspots have to be about 50,000 miles across to be visible from Earth with just your eyes. And as I repeat, do not look at the sun. Go online and learn how to observe sunspots, but never ever look at the sun with your eyes or through any type of optical equipment. You'll simply just burn your eyes. But at any rate, the point being that for something to be visible near the distance of the sun, to be visible with the naked eye, it has to be about 50,000 miles across. And this is well known to anybody who has studied astronomy or anything else. Jupiter, by contrast, is 89,000 miles in diameter, about 1.4 times as big as the average large sunspot, which would be 50,000 miles across. And, of course, everybody knows what Jupiter looks like in the night sky. It's a pretty bright, it looks like a great big star. Or Venus is much closer, and not quite as big. Venus is not quite as big as Earth. Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter, but Venus is closer to the sun. It's much brighter. But the point is that the absurdity of NASA saying that a 600-foot object, not miles, we're talking feet, the size of your feet, 600 of those wide object next to the sun in the early morning sky, and people could see that with their naked eye. Now, you need a sunspot 50,000 miles across to see it with equipment that where basically no amplification or no modification of the image through lensing and through magnification using a lens, 50,000 miles across for the naked eye to see. Okay, how about something 600 feet across, about a tenth of a mile? So absurd that I just have to keep kind of pounding on that. The absurdity of NASA saying that Comet Lovejoy was this teeny little snowball, went through the sun, went through the solar atmosphere, came out, and really was physically one of the biggest comets in history. Okay, so let me go on to... I have two main science topics tonight. I'm going to talk about sunspots. A listener wrote in and asked, what are sunspots? What are they and how do they form? And the other thing I want to explain is tail drag. Now, this is part of my theoretical work. It has to do with the comets that come into the solar system. Now, if a comet is dragging in tail material, then... Newton's law says for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. So, if the comet nucleus is pulling in tail material, then the tail material is pulling at the comet nucleus. And so, there's a bit of formulation involved here, but one of the very first things I did back in the 1970s when I was studying these phenomena in understanding these for the first time, that comets could not be dirty snowballs, but they're attracting the tail material and bringing it into the comet nucleus, is that this would cause what I call a drag, and that's the tail drag. Now, luckily, I was at Cornell University at the time, and I was burying myself in the Library of Congress that exists at Cornell. They had a book there. It's an extremely rare book. I can't imagine that there's more than a copy or two in the whole world, by a guy named two authors, George Darwin and TJJC. C is spelt like the S-E-E. That's the author's names. They went through an entire series of studies in the late 1800s. They were mathematicians and astronomers. And they determined that when you look at the planetary systems, they had to be formed by capture, and that the many of the properties of the planets had to be formed by capture. And of course, at the time, the dominant theory is the same one that's held today, where a big the standard science says that a big cloud of gas and dust formed into a rotating cloud, in that the planets and moons, etc., formed out of these and formed the solar system, and that this was the way all of the star systems formed, and therefore there should be planets around the various stars in the galaxy. Excuse me. Got to take a drink of water. Okay, so Darwin and C postulated that no... That doesn't explain things, and I know on a recent show I explained that if you take that nebular collapse Laplacian theory of how solar systems form from the big rotating cloud, all of the planets would spin backwards from what they currently spin. So how do you account for that? One of the main characteristics of planets, and all of the moons would spin backwards in their orbits. The moons in general go in a prograde orbit. So the moons would be spinning backwards. The whole solar system would be backwards from what we see. So it clearly doesn't work. It doesn't explain it. You can't explain all this by having asteroids collide in everything and get it the way you want it to be. So the nebular collapse theory collapses at first sight. It doesn't work. So at any rate, TJJC and Darwin explained this, and they were not welcomed with open arms, let's put it this way. They were not welcomed with open arms in the astronomical community. But they produced two vast volumes on the theoretical information that they developed. And I, luckily, as I said, I was at Cornell where they had a copy of these two magnificent large books. And I spent a great deal of time going through and studying their work. The only problem was, and it was determined later, that the resisting medium that they were looking for, they believed that the sun should be surrounded by a resisting medium in which the planets would move and slow down once they were captured. And that resisting medium had to be fairly thick to slow down a planet. Two things would happen. It would circularize the orbit. And the other effect was called eccentricity damping is the technical word. What that means is the orbit changes from an elliptical orbit into a circular orbit. So the two effects, energy dispersal and eccentricity damping, were the two effects that they discovered. The only problem was the sun doesn't have a resisting medium. And so for future moons and objects that came into the solar system, there was no resisting medium for them to use to slow down. So here I am developing my comet theoretical work, the plasma discharge comet model, showing that comet nuclei, some of the big ones can become planets and moons. They certainly can become captured. But it provided a new view for the resisting medium, because now the comet was like a huge cosmic vacuum cleaner, drawing in vast amounts of dust and gases from the solar system, and which is very sparse out there. A couple shows ago, I gave a lecture on how sparse material is in outer space, that there is more material in our atmosphere from ground up to about 60 miles from the ground than there is all the way to the far side of the universe, where you see other galaxies and quasars, etc. But the point is that our solar system is populated, has a good population of dust and gas in it, and so that is the source of material for the tails of comets. So the tails, the material that you find in the tails of comets, that material comes from just the expanse of gas and dust clouds, very sparse, in the solar system. But they're pulling in from an area of maybe 1 million to 10 million miles long. Comet tails are big. You can only see, when you look in a telescope, you might see a comet tail of, 1 million miles or 500,000 miles. But you don't see the part where this is funneling in from a vast part of the solar system, maybe 50 million miles or 100 million miles, and it's all being drawn into the comet nucleus, but it's so sparse out there you don't see it. Only when it gets nearer the comet nucleus do you finally see this material. But the point is that the comet nucleus, through powerful electrical forces, is drawing in the tail material. And if the gravitational field of the nucleus is large enough, that material will begin to accumulate and grow on the nucleus. And so you need the electrical forces pulling it in, plus a large enough gravitational field to hold it there. The small comets that NASA has visited are just teeny, and they don't really have any gravitational field. So once the ions get into that region, they are neutralized by electrons, and they go funneling out in the solar wind once they become neutrals. And so that is the mistake that NASA scientists make. when they put their satellites out there and they measure the material in the comet tail, they go, oh, those are neutrals coming off the nucleus. Well, no, that's part of a more complex process. But at any rate, so the small comets don't accumulate much of the matter. Therefore, they don't have much of their orbit changed due to tail drag, because it doesn't stick. It doesn't stick to the comet nucleus. The larger comets like Hale-Bopp, however, have their orbits changed quite radically on a daily basis, and that we did see in the data with Hale-Bopp, something that we did save all of those archives when the orbit of Hale-Bopp was being changed on a daily basis at the Smithsonian, where they keep the records, the orbital records. And then after all that was done, they came out and said, oh, Hale-Bopp had its orbit changed with one encounter when it came by Jupiter. Well, that's just ridiculous. It's just lying. It's hiding data. Nothing better, nothing worse. By people who are in the astronomy community to hide the effect, because with the dirty snowball comet model, only the smallest comets should have any orbital change. What they say it's caused by jetting. When the solar wind supposedly hits the comet nucleus, jets come out and might cause the orbit to change. But it's a random direction as the comet nucleus spins, and so there's really no, I don't quite see how this supposedly changes a direction, because as the nucleus spins, that force is in rotates around in a circular fashion, causing a force in all directions, and it equalizes and doesn't add up to any net force to move the nucleus. So their explanation doesn't make any sense at all. And besides, the small comets don't show significant orbital change and perturbation. The big comets do. And Hale-Bopp proved that 100%. But at any rate, okay, so what I wanted to do here is explain how tail drag circularizes in orbit. And I wanted to use specifically the example of the comet Venus. Okay, now Venus came in. And apparently the comet Venus was, some accounts say that it was seen before it encountered Jupiter, but whatever happened, it didn't pop out of Jupiter. It was captured by Jupiter. And so that's when it ignited into a big comet, and that's what really caught the attention of the ancients. When Venus came around, was captured into the inner solar system by Jupiter. And by the way, that was probably about the same time, the last time that Hale-Bopp was here. And I think that they came in together. They were here at about the same time. And probably a lot of other big comets at that time. And remember, that was worked up to about the time when Venus had an encounter with Earth. That's the Moses event. And the earlier it could have been, remember that as I talk about on my CDs, The Noah event with the Great Flood was a long, much, much earlier in history than the Moses event. Both are very characteristically dominated by comet activity. The Noah Flood and then the Moses event was different. It wasn't so much of a flood as the Noah event, and so two different comets? I think that there were two different comets. But at any rate, we don't know that for sure. There's not a lot of explanation there. But we do know from the Colburn that there were many, many big comets in the solar system at that time. Okay, so how could an object as big as Venus be captured into the solar system and then have its orbit circularized? And how could Venus then end up as a planet in a circular orbit inside of Earth's orbit? Well, as I said, comets are not dirty snowballs. They are a plasma discharge of the solar capacitor. Part of that process is for the nucleus on a big comet to attract the tail material, and that tail material comes in very, very hot, combining with the kinetic energy that comes into the nucleus. So you have a steaming hot planet complete with a volatile atmosphere of hydrocarbons. of hydrogen, nitrogen, all of those basics that are needed eventually to evolve life, oceans, etc. All of that comes into the atmosphere, but now Venus, as we see it today, is an extremely hot new planet. How did it get there? How did it get into its current orbit? Okay, so let's start with the capture of Venus, the comet. It comes around Jupiter, swings in, and it's captured by a gravitational process. Astronomers and space scientists today use the opposite. They call it a slingshot effect, where they'll take a satellite, they'll bring it around Jupiter, and that makes the satellite pick up energy. And it flings it out into the outer solar system, and so you have a lot less fuel to carry if you use that slingshot effect to send your satellite out into the outer solar system. The reverse effect of that slingshot effect is when an object comes in, you swing around the planet in the correct way, and the planet and the sun, the gravitational fields of that twin system, takes energy away from the object coming in. And then, now what do you need? Okay, now you have an object in an elliptical orbit, possibly extending out to Jupiter, and the inner part probably extending in maybe close to the orbit of Mars. In the case of Venus, it was in the plane of the planets, in the ecliptic. So now we have an object, a planet-sized object, in the form of a comet, in the plane of the planets, starting to work its way in. The tail drag does two things. It of course, is pulling back on the comet nucleus. It's like you put your hand in front of the comet nucleus, but in the direction of the tail. So that the comet nucleus is moving, and the tail is pulling back in the direction of the tail. That's the force on the nucleus. So this is constantly working on it as the nucleus pulls in and absorbs this material and assimilates this material into the nucleus. Okay, so I calculated at that time, and this is published in, by the way, you can see the three papers that resulted from this in the appendix of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, the three-part comet paper from the early, published in the early 1980s as a result of my first book, which was published when I was at Cornell in 1979, on the capture comets in the capture of processes in the development of solar systems. So, okay, I calculated at that time that at the rate of buildup, this would be about 1 meter per day, 1 meter per day of buildup on the planetary surface, it would take about 600 years for the comet Venus to wind its way in and finally settle into the orbit where we see Venus today. But there's one little problem. Mars and Earth are in the way. And yes, Venus would eventually, as it worked its way into the inner solar system, it would eventually encounter both Mars and Earth. And the historical record is very clear that, yes, we had that, Earth had two encounters. Velikovsky talks about that. It's very clear. And so does the Colbran, the ancient text that were handed down. Remember that the Colbran is a compilation of parts of books that were part of the original library of Joseph of Arimathea, who was the great uncle of Christ. And after the crucifixion, Joseph moved Mary, the two Marys actually, off to England, where he had his business. He traded in metals. He was a businessman. And so he took all of the, allegedly took the cross and took it to England, where it remains today in a hidden area. But the books, the libraries of Joseph of Arimathea were taken to an abbey in England, where they were kept into the Middle Ages by a group. The front name for that group is the Chaldean Trust, which exists today, the Chaldeans. And so at any rate, the book, as it was put together, back in the early 90s was a compilation of books that were still harbored by these people, and it was published. And by the way, don't be fooled by the Internet Amazon book. There's one that says Colburn. It is not the Colburn. My webpage has the true source for the Colburn. The ChaldeanTrust.org is the only place you can get the real Colburn. But the point is that the Colburn talks specifically about the many comets. And the comets did war in the skies. They talk about these comets assimilating one another as they battle it out in the sky. This must have been quite the sight. And, of course, when these came near Earth or they caused violent storms on the sun, then that's why, of course, NASA has to deny that comets are anything but little snowballs. That's why they have to deny that comets can cause effects on the sun, because if we ever see one of these big babies come through the solar system, they're going to be out there screaming about how this little snowball 10 feet across is causing all of this, and nobody's going to believe them. And that's why it's very clear that standard science has to maintain this ridiculous fairy tale science. It's to protect the bankers who fund the science. It's that cycle of funding and who gets the money and who has to say what to stay in business. And all the other sciences follow: geology, planetary evolution, evolution, biological evolution, and all of the other anthropological sciences hooked together all have to say, if you want to be in a university, you better toe the party line or you're going to be flipping burgers someplace. And so most people choose to have the party line and keep their nice government-paid job or university-paid job, and life is good, except they're peddling complete BS in the universities and in the schools today. But don't mind that. They get their paycheck. So, as I say, life is good. But the point is that the explanation for how comets come into the solar system and become planets in nice circularized orbits in short amount of time is completely explained by the tail drag. And you can, you can calculate. If you add 1 meter of material to a planet like Venus, and you take the vector that that's coming in on, and you pull back on that nucleus while it's in its elliptical orbit, you go back to the work of Darwin and See in the 1800s when they developed the first capture theory of solar system development. But remember, they didn't have they call it the secular action of the resisting medium. Those are the terms that Darwin and See used to describe the capture process and the necessary slowing down. Once you get these things captured, how do you slow them down? How do you get them into nice circular orbits? Well, they said there has to be a resisting medium out there, but when astronomers went out and looked for that resisting medium, it was not there. And you could speculate, for example, it was there in the beginning of the solar system, but not now. But the point is that any future captured moons, for example, wouldn't have any, they would not have this resisting medium to allow the capture to take place. So they had to abandon that theory. But when I came along, I said, no, of course there's no resisting medium, but the resisting medium takes on a much more subtle aspect to it. That the resisting medium comes in when the comet, and of course See and Darwin didn't recognize that comets would be part of this system, that the comets became moons and planets, the big ones. Little comets don't become anything. They just float around and have a hot surface burned on them from the tars and the hydrocarbons, etc. But the big comets, a tremendous amount of energy put into them, so they're firing and hot. And when they eventually cool down, they go through the cooling stage, and those chemicals change. Like right now, there's a tremendous amount of sulfur dioxide on Venus. that will eventually break down, and eventually the hydrogens and the oxygens will combine in a different form to form water. Also, during these epochs, other comets are going to come through. Venus will pass through the tail of those comets and provide more water for the oceans, just like Earth has happened with Earth. Venus is at the beginning of its planetary life. And so, at any rate, the point is, how do these planets, if the capture scenario is correct, how do planets become circularized from something that comes in and is captured? That is explained by the comet tail drag. The time it takes, the estimated times are within the range that, for example, we know Venus took probably about that amount of time, 600 years to 1,000 years, and dominated the sky. Why do you think that the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Incas, the Chinese, and by the way, this is the year of the dragon, the Chinese year of the dragon. You know, in the Chinese parades and the long, fiery dragon with the flowing tail and the fire coming out its mouth, does that represent something from Earth? No. The dragon in Chinese lore is in the sky. The dragon in the sky that dominated the landscape, that caused the recycling of man, the renovation of man. In every culture, there is a similar deity, the phoenix in the southwest, the Kachina dolls, the Inca, Maya, Aztecs, Quetzalcoatl. Of course, the Aztecs were much later in history and adopted the image of Quetzalcoatl, and it's not so prominent in Aztec mythology, which concentrates on the moon and the sun. And the moon and the sun are the dominant, but the Aztecs were farther removed in history. The Mayans and the Incas still maintained Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent guy of the sky, that eventually his heart became the planet Venus. Those are the deities, and the Chinese dragon represents the comet, the large comet in the sky. And of course, we're dealing with an interesting combination of intelligence in the ancient Mayas and in the Chinese, and to record what happened and try and hand this down, but also an ignorance of outer space. What was outer space? What were these comets? How did they, you know, the workings of the solar system, gravity, electromagnetic forces, the vacuum of outer space. I mean, they had no concept of these, the solar wind, that there were protons in the solar wind that outnumbered electrons and causing a differential electric field in the solar wind. They didn't have this information, so they describe it and carry it on in history and mythology. So this is what we have to work with today, and of course standard science has to deny this to maintain the standard, the status quo. Let me go through my notes here. I may come back to this topic next week. Just a recap, sunspot 1429 is having a big flare. It's the flare is hitting Earth today, and make sure you go out tonight and look for the auroras. Just a little other mention about Velikovsky is that standard science tried to negate the concept or the fact that Velikovsky and Einstein were good buddies. And the fact is that they said, oh, it's just when Einstein died, the book that he had open on his desk was Velikovsky's World in Collision. And it was, I've seen a picture of the desk, you know, Einstein's desk, the way it was when he died. And there's open, big as the day, big as life, Velikovsky's World in Collision. It's something that scientists really want to negate and deny. But the history of Einstein and Velikovsky goes way back to the 1920s, when Velikovsky was in Berlin, when Velikovsky was he moved to Israel and then finally to New York. But all of this time, Einstein and him were good buddies. There were all kinds of... Einstein went over to his house to play the violin. You know, these guys knew each other for decades and decades. And so I wanted to clarify that the minimizing of the Velikovsky-Einstein relationship is something that standard science wants to do, but it's only out of ignorance that they do that, because the majority of people in standard science have no clue what they're talking about. They just make blank statements that have no basis just to protect themselves. But what was Einstein's interest in Velikovsky's work? Well, at the time, Einstein's very last work was on the unification of the fields, the four fields known in nature. Gravity, electromagnetic, nuclear. The nuclear has two forces, the strong and the weak. And he was trying to combine those. Einstein was trying to combine those into a unified theory. And so he was very interested in Velikovsky's observations that electromagnetism had something to do with outer space. And, of course, Einstein died before he ever could pursue that, and there wasn't enough information at the time. They didn't know about the solar wind. All kinds of things were not known at the time when Einstein died. But in Einstein's last writing, out of my later years, I forget what the page number, Einstein makes the statement. He says, I don't believe general relativity. I don't believe the principle of equivalence. And therefore, there has to be something else. And he was trying to dig into that connection, the Velikovsky connection, to try and figure out what role electromagnetism had in outer space. And so at any rate, when I was at Cornell, that's what I discovered, the connection there. And there's a lot of clowns running around the Internet, jumping up and down, who don't know anything about science. The electrical connections to the solar system are very subtle, and they only work in very certain situations. So at any rate, the issue with electromagnetism in the solar system is that it only works under certain very strict conditions. Our weather is caused by electromagnetism in the solar system. We're seeing it right now with the solar flare coming in. It's affecting Earth weather. I'm just about out of time. Just remind you that I still have the 2-for-1 sale on the webpage. Go there, JMCC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo, JMCCSCI.com. That's just to help pay for the recent printings of three of the books, the Calculate Primes, the Planet X books, and the Atlantis to Tesla books. All were just reprinted. And so that sale will end probably this week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.